Radio EcoShock.
Living things can be found deep in the rock and floating high in the atmosphere. As life and this planet blend together, does a new level of being emerge? What or who is Gaia? All this is professionally explored by Ferris Jaber in his book Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. Ferris publishes articles with The New Yorker, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and Scientific American. He has received fellowships from major American universities. From Portland, Oregon, Ferris Jaber, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's first travel to the places we don't go, and then we will tackle the bigger picture of Gaia. How can anything live deep underground in the rock and never see sunlight or water from the clouds?
Yeah, it's truly astonishing just how much life is living very deep within the rocky crust of the planet. Just a few decades ago, scientists didn't really think anything lived down there, and it now turns out that perhaps the majority of microbes, of microorganisms on the planet, may live within the planet's rocky crust. And it turns out that this crust is not just solid rock. It's actually perfused with all kinds of fissures and cracks that are full of water. And in general, wherever you find water, you find life. Now, because these microbes are cut off from sunlight and from easy access to oxygen, they've had to find different ways of making energy and sustaining themselves. So they've learned to essentially breathe and eat the rocks and metals and minerals around them.
A few years ago, we talked with microbiologist David Thaler. He said, not only do we not have any map or catalog of microscopic life, but such a project is impossible because new organisms can appear in a day among billions of species. So Gaia inventor James Lovelock would ask, what is the purpose of this underground life? How does it tie into the overall project? Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think one thing that's particularly interesting about these so-called intraterrestrial microbes is that they may be some of the living microbes today that are most similar to what life looked like billions of years ago. You know, when single-celled organisms first emerged billions of years ago, they may have emerged in parallel in multiple places on the planet. So they may have started out in the deep crust, in the deep ocean, perhaps on the surface. And they may have had very unusual ways of making a living and getting energy that is, you know, not as common today. So the, you know, the microbes that we're most familiar with may not be the ones that most closely resemble what the earliest life forms looked like. So I think that these microbes that live really far away from us are in some ways a window into the past. They're a way for us to time travel and see what life might have been like a long time ago when the Earth was very different from today.
And some people think, well, maybe the first life traveled to Earth buried in an asteroid. What do you think? Is there any science around this, or is it just an idea?
It seems to have sort of remained mostly an idea. You know, it's certainly not entirely implausible. We know that sometimes really massive rocks enter our planet's atmosphere, and they leave giant chunks, you know, meteorites the size of boulders on the surface. So if something that large can survive the journey and there is life embedded within it, you know, that is a possibility. But there's no really clear, compelling evidence that that is the case, that that is how life first emerged here. So I think most scientists don't really put that much stock in that notion.
Well, going to the other extreme, when we look up in the sky, we don't usually think there's a lot of living things up there, but there are. And along those lines, scientists discover trees in the Amazon can stimulate their own weather. And you wrote about this. Amazon rainforests even influence weather in the northern hemisphere. Could you talk about how that might work?
Yeah, so the Amazon rainforest generates about half of the rain that falls on its canopy each year. And it really involves all of the life in the forest. So the trees and plants are collectively pulling huge volumes of water from the soil with their roots and then releasing what they don't use to the atmosphere. So saturating the air with huge volumes of water vapor. And at the same time, the forest is breathing out this potpourri of tiny biological particles, things like microbes and pollen grains and fungal spores. And the water vapor combines and condenses on all of those little particles, which is how clouds form. So the life being, you know, breathed out of the forest combined with all the water vapor dramatically accelerates cloud formation in the rain cycle. And this generates a massive flying river of precipitation that travels throughout South America. And then because the atmosphere is one big entity and it's all interconnected, what happens over one continent affects what's happening elsewhere in the world. So this massive flying river generated by the Amazon is having these ripple effects, these teleconnections through the atmosphere, and is influencing precipitation as far away as Canada and the Pacific Northwest.
And I really enjoyed in your book the description of going up the Measuring Tower, the highest human-made structure in South America. Why is it there, and what was it like?
Yes, the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory is in the heart of the Amazon rainforest in a protected area, and scientists come from all over the world to climb it and to study the relationship between the atmosphere and the forest. And it's basically like a giant utility tower, a massive steel staircase in the middle of the rainforest. And so you have to be harnessed onto it, onto the railing as you climb up, just in case you slip through one of the many gaps. And when you make it to the top, which takes a few hours of climbing, you are literally halfway between the treetops, the canopy, and the clouds. And you can see this process of the Amazon making its own rain and clouds happen. You can see the mist coming off of the forest, rising up, forming the clouds, and then falling back down again as rain. And it's a really interesting place to build a research station because it's protected. The air is a lot cleaner and more pure than in other parts of the world. And so you can really see, you know, what the atmosphere is like just in relationship to the forest as opposed to industry.
I guess you couldn't go up there in high wind situations.
No, and you have to be careful about the weather and storms. You know, you don't want to be on this giant lightning rod in the middle of a thunderstorm. So if it does start to get too rainy and stormy, you need to hike back down really quickly.
It's so weird to think the upper air is alive with living things that can travel and maybe reproduce far away. How would you describe life in the atmosphere?
Yeah, I think of it as heaven's microbiome. You know, we know that we and all complex living creatures are ecosystems. We're walking ecosystems. We have microorganisms in and on and around us all the time. And the same is really true of all bodies, all ecosystems throughout our planet. We used to think that there wasn't any life up in the clouds, but it turns out that microbes are continually being whisked off of the land and sea and up into the air because they are so tiny and essentially weightless. And once they get up there, they can actually hang around and form communities for weeks to months, even sometimes eating or reproducing within the clouds and then returning to the surface in precipitation, in rain and snow and hail. So scientists have found microbes inside hailstones and snow crystals and rain all over the world. And some of these microbes are actually actively changing the weather. There's a particular bacterium that has proteins on its surface that actually encourage liquid water molecules to freeze into a solid ice crystal. So it can start these chain reactions of crystallization within rain clouds. And when it does that, it makes the clouds much larger and heavier much really quickly, and that encourages them to fall as rain, as precipitation. So it actually helps the microbes return to the surface. So they've potentially evolved these strategies to, deal with constantly being whisked up into the atmosphere and then getting back down to the ground, and in the process are changing the meteorology of the whole planet.
Well, let's approach this concept of Gaia. Does that name point to a super system, a new type of being, or how do you see it?
Well, when Lovelock initially was writing about Gaia in the 70s and 80s, he did often call it a being. He would sometimes call it a superorganism. But over time, James Lovelock and his many collaborators, including the American biologist Lynn Margulis, they refined their ideas. They clarified what they were talking about. And the modern evolution is to think of Earth as an interconnected living system. it's not a superorganism. It's actually the largest known living system. It's one big interconnected system in which all the animate and inanimate parts are working in concert. And it is analogous to, smaller but complex living entities like ourselves. We also are these jumbles of the animate and the inanimate. You know, most of our bodies is actually inanimate water and mineral and such, and then we only have so many actual living cells and tissues, but it all works together as one big system. So that's how I've really come to think of Earth, is that, it's a vast, interconnected living system. It's really life on the scale of a planet. You know, that's what it looks like when a whole planet comes to life.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex continues with Ferris Jaber, author of Becoming Earth.
Back in 2009, I spoke with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. He criticized the Gaia concept, publishing a counter-theory called the Medea Hypothesis. Ward would probably accept that a new overarching operating system, if you will, has appeared on Earth, but not that it has any purpose. Do you need to have a purpose in order to have Gaia?
I don't think so, and I think that's one of the things that's been clarified over time, is that in the beginning, Lovelock put too much purpose, too much agency, too much teleology into Gaia, and over time realized that that was not necessary. You know, that's not really how evolution works. We don't have to be working towards some sort of explicit goal. It's more of an emergent phenomenon. You know, there are certain physical and chemical conditions in place. Certain things are possible, certain things happen, and this results in astonishing complexity and beauty, but there isn't necessarily some explicit goal or driving purpose behind it all.
Well, before speaking to you, I reread my copy of James Lovelock's original 1979 book, Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. Lovelock criticizes environmentalists at the time for their focus on their own industrial societies. He suggested the real places where Earth's environment pivots away from current life will be found in marshes and coastal shelves, as well as underreported changes in the tropics. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, the latest science that I'm finding says that's probably true. That is where the action's taking place.
Yeah, you know, Lovelock was such an interesting character. He was a real maverick scientist, and he published a lot of different views over his lifetime, some of which contradicted each other. You know, his first book on Gaia was just his first, and he ended up publishing a whole series, and he, you know, had this real evolution of thought. And when it comes to his opinions on environmentalism and industry, there's definitely some contradictions, you know, embedded in there in the overall literature. But I think on the whole, we see that he absolutely accepted the reality of climate change, that, you know, the fossil fuel industry was what was driving climate change. And he was really interested in this idea of, you know, how can we sort of apply the concepts of biology and medicine to the planet as a whole and think about how to help the planet heal, how to help the planet recover from this shock, this crisis that we had forced it into. And I do think there's something useful about that, because I do think that, you know, the planet is this immense living being, and we have pushed it into this crisis state, and it has recovered from such crises many times in the past, but it always takes a really long time to do so, and in the process, many, many species can go extinct, and obviously that is not something that is compatible with modern human civilization. So our task right now is trying to figure out how to help our planet recover much more quickly and much more safely, so that it does not enter one of these, you know, extremely unstable recovery periods that we probably will not survive.
Do you have any suggestions on how to bring the public realization that we are a part of life, not separate, that we are tiny parts of a planetary thing?
Well, that's really, you know, one of the major tasks that my book is engaged with, and I hope that kind of science writing can help people understand. You know, one of the most personal ways in which I engage with this has been through my garden. Gardening became really important to me in the course of writing this book. And when I'm out there, I can really feel a visceral connection to the planet in a way I couldn't before. I think it really forces you to slow down and pay attention and really, you know, observe the minutiae of a single leaf or blade of grass or these tiny micro communities and ecosystems that really exist all around us.
Ferris, what are you watching and working on these days?
I have been working on a series of climate change articles for the New York Times Magazine, where I'm a contributing writer. I published one earlier this year in which I went to Australia to spend some time with scientists who are looking at changing the weather above the Great Barrier Reef as a way to potentially help the corals endure the warming and bleaching that they've been suffering from. So these scientists are trying to generate fog and brighten clouds to reflect more light and heat and cool down the water for the corals. And then more recently, I've been looking into the issue of ocean acidification and carbon dioxide removal and, you know, the latest thinking from the scientific community on these subjects.
And so how do our listeners follow your work?
My website is just my name, ferrisjaber.com, and I list all my articles there, and they can look out for my work in the New York Times Magazine. And I'm also on social media. I'm active on Instagram and Blue Sky under my name as well.
And Jaber is spelled J-A-B-R, so it's ferrisjaber.com. From Portland, we've been speaking with author and science journalist Ferris Jaber. You can check out his book, Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. And you can also find further discussion in my own weekly blog at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.